Your name, please?
Langston Hughes.
And your profession?
Author, primarily, in the eyes of the public at least, poet.
Mr. Hughes, do you think that Americans appreciate poets?
My viewpoint is that they do if poetry is brought directly to the people in a simple fashion. I do not believe that we have the same appreciation for poetry in our country that one finds in Latin America or in most of Europe. But I know from many years of reading my poems in public that when poetry is brought directly to the people, they listen to it with interest, they appreciate it, and they buy the books.
This is Viewpoint, an unrehearsed and personal interview with another distinguished and well-known personality who will reveal to you, the American public, what he holds to be the responsibilities of his position in American life, produced by the Episcopal Church and brought to you as a public service by this station. Mr. Kennedy's guest today is Langston Hughes, known as the Poet Laureate of the Negro People. His works include the successful stage and television musical Simply Heavenly. Here is the moderator of the award-winning series Viewpoint, the Reverend Dana F. Kennedy, Executive Secretary, Division of Radio and Television for the National Council of the Protestant Episcopal Church. Mr. Kennedy.
Welcome to Viewpoint, Mr. Langston Hughes. What inspired you to get into the matter of writing poetry?
Well, I can't really say that I was inspired. It came about through a kind of accident. I was in the eighth grade in Lincoln, Illinois, a new student in the class on the day before they were holding the class elections. And they had nominated the various officers, president, secretary, treasurer, and so on, but there were no nominations for class poet on the day of the elections. The day before, the teacher had stressed rhythm. Well, when they got on to class poets on the day of the elections, no nominations, everybody looked around each other, didn't see anybody who even looked like a poet. I, a strange boy in the class, one of the two Negro pupils there. Finally, a little white boy got up and nominated me, and the whole class said I unanimously, and that's the way I became a poet.
Well, that's most interesting. I was intrigued, too. You said there was no one there that looked like a poet. Is a poet supposed to look a certain way?
Well, I think people have a sort of conventional idea that anyone who writes poetry is liable to look like what we think of nowadays as beatniks, or at least have long hair. But that's not true at all.
What is the special talent that makes a man or a woman a poet?
Well, a quality of rhythm in one's sensitivity in the use of words, I would say, and I think that's what caused the students to elect me that day, because the teacher said a poem has to have rhythm. And in stressing rhythm, you know, there's a kind of conventional belief in our country that all Negroes have a sense of rhythm, and we can sing and dance, which is not 100% true either, but my little white classmates, I suppose, connecting up poetry, rhythm, looking around, seeing me, picked me out. Otherwise, I'll never know exactly why they did. But I'm glad they did. I'm glad I became the class poet in the eighth grade in Lincoln, Illinois, because that started my writing career.
Well, in addition to rhythm, is there something else that makes a person a good poet?
I would think that one needs a very deep sensitivity to the problems of the average human being. I think perhaps one reason contemporary poetry is not held in too high a repute in our country, or not too widely read, is that it is so often too very personal, just about the poet's own problems. I think the great poets, American and otherwise, Carl Sandburg, Walt Whitman, Robert Frost, have been poets whose sensitivity extended over a very wide area, and whose poems encompass the emotions and problems of many people, not just themselves alone, personally, you know?
Well, isn't the problem of any special person apt to be the common problem of all of his brothers?
It is, if it is a basic problem. But some modern poets, for example, will write a poem in which they will mention, say, the Charles River and the oleander bush and the rocking chair, and if you don't know, it's the river of their childhood. If you don't know, the oleander bush is the one beside the door where they used to play. The symbolism and the implications are so personal, oftentimes, that they don't reach a broad audience. You see what I mean? Whereas in Sandburg's poems, by and large, that's not true. The poems about the wheat fields, about Chicago, about the steel mills, are poems that in which a great many people can identify with something in them, you see? Yes, you're quite right. A personal problem can be maybe a problem of a great many people, but when it's expressed too personally, it doesn't carry over to others.
When you go about writing a poem, do you sit down and say, now I'll write a poem?
No, I don't. I think some poets do. All writers work differently, and poets who work in the formal forms, like the sonnet, for example, or the rondeau, work out their forms, work out their subject matter sometimes, and mold the two together. I am the kind of poet who writes largely by ear, I think, and whatever thought comes into my mind that I wish to put down, usually it comes in the form of a line or two, like one of my poems, I've Known Rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world. Well, that thought came to me in those lines, and then I extended it by giving it thought and by thinking about it and by a little work.
Well, what kind of influences shape your work? Well, let's take the illustration you've just given, that you've known rivers as ancient as the world. What sort of things through your life come to a focus when you start writing this poem?
That particular poem came about by childhood memories, a fusion of hearing my grandmother talk about being sold on the Mississippi in slavery time was one of the worst things that could happen to a Negro. By hearing a little about Africa in my childhood and the greatness of the African kingdoms in ancient Africa. And so I was on a train going to Mexico where my father lived after I graduated from high school. And the train went across the Mississippi River just outside St. Louis. And it was evening time, dusk. And looking out the window at this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, I thought about these things that I've just said and sort of personalizing it all, making myself the I for the Negro people. The lines came, I've known rivers, and most of my poems are short. This one is not more than 12 lines, so I put it down on the back of my father's letter I had in my pocket, and it was written perhaps in 10 or 15 minutes.
Mr. Hughes, do you find that religious faith of any kind influences your work?
Yes, I would think very much so. I grew up in a not very religious family, but I had a foster aunt who saw that I went to church and Sunday school quite a deal in my childhood, and I was very much moved always by the, shall I say, the rhythms of the Negro church, the rhythms of the spirituals, the rhythms of those wonderful old-time sermons that they used to preach in sort of poetic intonation, you know? And when I began to write poetry, that influence came through in, quite a number of my poems. For example, in my book, The Dreamkeeper, I have a section called Feet of Jesus, and this is one of the poems. At the feet of Jesus, sorrow like a sea. O Lord, let your mercy come drifting down on me. At the feet of Jesus, at your feet I stand. Oh, my precious Jesus, please reach out your hand. That particular one has been set to music and has been sung by Marian Anderson and a number of other singers. And if I may, I'd like to read one more that I can give you the exact background for. There was in this little church in Lawrence, Kansas, where I grew up, a very old lady who came to church every Sunday morning, dressed very neatly and very clean, but quaintly, you know, an old-fashioned shirt waist with staves up under her chin, a dress with wide ruffles around the bottom. Sometimes some of the younger people in the church were inclined to laugh and giggle a little bit when this old lady came down the aisle, and one day someone must have said something that she overheard that hurt her feelings, because she turned around right in the middle of the church aisle and she looked at the group of young people and she said, "That's all right," she said, "y'all can be stuck up if you wanna. Laugh at me if you wanna, but my Lord ain't stuck up." And with that, she turned around and went down to her seat in the Amen corner. Well, now that line, "My Lord Ain't Stuck Up," remained in my head many years. It later came out in a poem called My Lord. My Lord ain't no stuck-up man. My Lord, he ain't proud. When he goes a-walking, he gives me his hand. You my friend, he lowed. My lord knowed what it was to work. He knowed how to pray. My lord's life was trouble too. Trouble every day. My lord ain't no stuck-up man. He's a friend of mine. When he went to heaven, his soul on fire, he told me I was gwine. He said, sure, you'll come with me and be my friend through eternity.
That's very lovely. Do you find that in your poems you try to convey a message?
Oh, I think most of the time I do. This particular poem, I suppose subconsciously I was trying to say that when religion places itself at the service of mankind, particularly the humble people, it can give them something to help sustain them and strengthen them and guide them. And I'm a great believer in the social aspects of religion.
You don't confine religion to being a mystical experience that you enjoy all by yourself, then?
No, I'm not inclined to feel that way myself. I think there's great beauty in the mysticism of much religious writing and great help there, but I also think that we live in a world which is a world of solid earth and vegetables and a need for jobs and a need for housing, and I think you can't detach the two, really.
Do you feel that the Negro people have had full opportunity to grow to their greatest extent here in this country?
Oh no, I don't. Couldn't possibly feel that. I'm sure you don't either.
No, I asked the question because I wanted your feeling about it.
I'm sure that everyone knows that our country and South Africa have been the two parts of the world that, in relation to colored people, have had the most stringent segregations. And even yet, big, beautiful, million-dollar schools are kept closed. White and Negro children, nobody goes to school, simply because they don't want a few colored kids to sit in the same classroom with the whites. And you read right now, it's worth a Negro's life to try to vote in some parts of the South. No, we haven't had an equal opportunity here, and what do you call those kind of questions? Rhetorical questions, don't you?
Yes, but I think a truth has to be said again and again, even so. Mr. Hughes, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the progress we're making for equality in this country?
I'm optimistic because there's been very definite progress within the last 10 or 15 years, particularly since the war. In fact, some very great strides in certain fields.
Why, in a city like New York, do most of the Negro celebrities forsake Harlem as soon as they can and go somewhere else to live?
A great many do so, just as most, I wouldn't say most whites, but just as many whites in the celebrity class move to Westchester, or move to Long Island, or someplace. And the same thing is true of those Negroes who are successful financially.
Thank you very much, Mr. Langston Hughes, for being with us and for giving us your viewpoints.
This has been Viewpoint, an unrehearsed personal interview with another distinguished and well-known personality, produced as a public service by the Division of Radio and Television of the Protestant Episcopal Church. Today's guest was Langston Hughes, known as the Poet Laureate of the Negro People. His works include the successful stage and television musical, Simply Heavenly.